So where's our microphone, man? He's gone. He's made an arrangement.
We can just pull that over and put it in my cup. It'll just be a little louder than usual.
Well, no, we need to pick this one to be recorded.
He said it picks up.
Even from way over there?
Yeah. Well, but not to move it around the table at all.
Okay.
So if we get this close, so that's for this table. We'll discover that.
I want to be sure to see you all. I hope I have. I'm moving over. Hi. My name is Kim McCall. Welcome to the session, which was perhaps unfortunately entitled If I Ran the Temple. I've said this title to a lot of people, and I guess you're the group that didn't get scandalized or did and needed to find out what it's about. I didn't mean it to be terribly scandalous. I have a habit of picking titles that are eye-grabbing and then hopefully presenting less, I don't know. The analogy, well, I don't know. There was a period of time when I sensed that my personal visits to the temple were less rewarding and fulfilling and whatever than I wished they were, and I, of course, blamed it on the temple. And so I thought, now if I ran the temple, it would be like this. And then I thought better later and decided I could do a few things myself about it. But I had a favorite children's book, which was called I Ran the Zoo, so this is called If I Ran the Temple. my mother read Dr. Seuss to us when we were little kids. And I hope that this would be a little lighthearted without being light-minded. My intention is actually to have as serious as possible and intellectually stimulating a discussion of how the temple affects us, how we can affect our own experience, and some things historical or from other cultures that we could understand about the temple and could inform our experience of it. I will talk, at least in my section, about things that I would add or things that I would do to improve my own other people like me's experience at the temple. But I want to say a couple of things. I'm aware, and actually my recent experience in the temple has mostly been really good, and I'm aware that a lot of people find the temple just tremendously rewarding and tremendously enriching, and I hope that nothing anybody says today will detract from that in any way, and nobody on the panel intends to, or they wouldn't be allowed to be on the panel. And we want to be respectful, if we can, of everyone's experience there. This is not an expose about the temple. No one is going to talk in detail about the ceremony or the wording or anything like that. So if that was what you were hoping to be scandalized by, you can go to another session. It's a really sensitive topic. I have been informed by expert authority that even discussing the temple at all outside of the temple is viewed really, really, really sensitively by people in Salt Lake. And I hope to be really sensitive to those concerns and respectful of them. And we'll see how it's received. But we're going to go in the order because there's one principle about the order that we're going to go in, but it's we're going to go in the order that we're listed on the program because there's not a whole lot of reason to change it. I would introduce each of these people had they given me a piece of paper describing them. There is one for Bonnie Mitchell sitting on the kitchen table. Okay, so I'm Kim McCall. I got a degree in philosophy and another degree in computer science, and I teach gospel doctrine in two different wards, and that's what Albert chose to emphasize in putting it on the program. Bonnie Mitchell has a PhD in sociology from the University of Texas, has taught in Korea, has headed a multicultural center at Southern Utah State University, and currently spends time giving time and energy to causes that she believes in. Todd Compton was recently acknowledged in a science fiction book dedicated to him as a classicist and rock musician. a PhD in ancient Greek studies and from UCLA, and a very serious student of the lives and Experiences of the Wise of Joseph Smith, on which he has written a tome, which he won't probably do a whole lot about in this session, but usually does in most instances, and already has today. Anne Kanan has a PhD in Shakespearean studies, has, pardon? No, she doesn't. I'm wrong about that. Okay, never mind. I'll get several things wrong about Anne. She did graduate studies at American Conservatory Theater's program.
They don't give PhDs.
They don't give PhDs. That's why she doesn't have one. She's a Shakespearean scholar. The San Jose Shakespeare Festival, she is a dramaturge. San Francisco Shakespearean Festival?
A teacher
at San Francisco Shakespearean Festival, and dramaturge and gopher and all kinds of facilitation for City Lights
Downtown San Jose,
Theater. Teaches Shakespeare at West Valley College. All right. I have been struck by the fact that when we are being endowed with power from on high, what we get is in great measure a drama. And I wanted somebody to comment on the history of drama in religion and religion and drama. And we'll do our best to do some of that. I'm told by church leadership that there are many unwritten rules that, although you'll find them nowhere in the scriptures, they, by long tradition, can be seen to be the order of the church. And one of them is that whenever you have a visiting general authority, he speaks last. We are honored to have in our presence today a visiting general authority, and Albert, who needs less introduction than the rest of us, and edits Sunstone and is the Mr. Sunstone these days, as Lori put it, will correct all of our mistakes and leave us all feeling good. And then we'll have time for some degree of discussion. Okay, enough of all that. With the amount of education up here, everybody's given 10 minutes, and I'll be amazed if any of us can limit ourselves to that. But, okay. Where's my watch? Okay, we're getting started late, too. All right. So I go first and set the wrong tone. All right. One of the things, I love being in church. I love Sundays. I love going to church, and I saw myself at a certain point going to church and just loving it all the time and not wanting to go to the temple and not having fun at the temple and not feeling rewarded for going to the temple. And I managed to do enough reflection to realize that at least one thing that was going on is that when I was at the temple, I was listening and I was sitting and I was, hardly anything besides that. And when I go to church, I teach, okay, and I love interaction. I love the chance to make it in the way that somebody else do something, or to have a difference made in the way I do something by something that somebody says, okay. And I love the social aspect of the gospel, not in the sense of punch and cookies, but in the sense that I'm relating to a group of people who all believe this stuff together and are trying to sort it out, and trying to understand each other's faith and trying to encourage each other's righteousness and or something, whatever we're doing on Sundays. But I'm teacher, okay, and people who watch me teach understand that's my identity in a whole lot of ways. And to sit and watch a movie that's the same every time was not doing it for me. And I want to acknowledge that I'm not everybody is like me, okay? There are people who come to my classes who just sit and listen. I guess they still come, but I'm a talker and a teacher and a seminar student and not a passive absorber, as I put it here. And there's this feeling that it's natural enough that the endowment is an individual experience, okay? That you go and you're going to be endowed, whatever that means, and we're not going to go into detail on it, but. For a long time, it's natural enough to think that this is that religion and the covenant making and the things that go on in the temple is an individual experience, and you're supposed to ponder about it, you're supposed to make these promises yourself, and so forth and so on. If you will pay attention the next time you go to the temple, you'll notice that there are promises that we make as a group. Okay, not only each of us, but all of us together make certain covenants. And the endowment is not just when the great revelation that led to the building of the temple was given in section 88 of the Doctrine and Covenants. I was going to read it, but you all know that it says, "Build, prepare a needful thing, and build a house of learning." Okay. And to me, one of the things that I would like to see more of in the temple is what I would recognize as it being a house of learning, as it being a house where there's real kind of discourse that goes on that feels to me like teaching and learning. Now, people can sit and meditate and learn a lot, and I am always astonished at the amount that people can figure out for themselves when they're just sitting there. For me, it often takes interaction, but anyway, I feel like there was a time when there was something that they called the School of the Prophets, where there were a lot of things that went on in the temple, and a lot of things that went on in the School of Prophets that have been absorbed into the endowment, but there were a lot of things that haven't, which had to do with discussion of great doctrines, with the lectures that were given there, with the attempt to come to understand the gospel. And to the extent that all of us have a lot of understanding yet to do in the gospel, I would like to see a return to something that would have the same effect in the lives of the people that go there as the School of Prophets did, that there would be a place. Now, we can all go to our Sunday school classes and we can all learn a lot. I want to remind you of a couple of things. When we go to Sunday school, there's only a certain level of discourse that we can reach. You know that not everybody there is... When you give a talk in sacrament meeting, you have to limit yourself to a certain extent on what you talk about and how you talk about it because of the variety of people that are there and the variety of levels of commitment and various things like that. When I read the Book of Mormon and taught the Book of Mormon passages in which... I may actually read this one to you because it's so powerful. And it came to pass that he went again a little way off and prayed to the Father, and tongue cannot speak the words which he prayed, neither can be written by man the words which he prayed, and the multitude did hear and do bear record, and their hearts were open, and they did understand in their hearts the words which he prayed. Nevertheless, so great and marvelous were the words which he prayed that they cannot be written, neither can they be uttered by man. What I thought about when I read that the last time we went through it was the idea that people actually understood. It wasn't that he was explaining, you know, impossible to understand things. What I felt was that this is happening at a time when the crowd has been purged of unbelievers. Okay, everybody who's listening is a believer in Christ at this point. And Christ is able to talk in a language and in a way that is appropriate for that audience. And in that context, you can't write down those things for general consumption. And what I would like to believe is that if we were all in the temple together, that there would be a kind of talking and a kind of discourse and a kind of investigation, a level of inquiry and a level of testimony or whatever, inspiration, that is possible in few other places, okay, because of the joint commitment, because of the joint testimony of the people that are there. And I would like to experience that. It doesn't have to be deep and mysterious doctrines, you know. Joseph went a long way trying to understand and discuss faith and the atonement. And each of us has an immense amount to learn about that, and we could learn it. And we could explore it and come to know it better through wrestling it with it together in a place as sacred and as unified as that. So I would have much more frequent temple sessions. I would go in groups. I would have groups go having prepared with readings and assigned discussion leaders, and have rooms set aside in the temple for people who came in that spirit and with that desire to have those sorts of discussions. I've actually implemented this in a small way in my own life. I've gone recently with people that I care about and who love to discuss the sorts of things that I love to discuss. And on a personal level, it's been immensely more rewarding for me to go with the simpatico people and to experience that, and I would love to do it in larger groups. All right, am I out of time yet? No, not quite. There's one other thing one of the, actually several, several things I had intended to say, maybe we'll get to some of them. But the other major one, there's a temptation among Mormons, among all of us, among people generally. You of course want to believe that, and one of the ways of convincing yourself that you're good is to do all the things that you're commanded, and to do all your duties and perform all your rites. And it's very important, from the spirit of pure religion and undefiled, not to allow ourselves to be convinced that going through a bunch of actions in the right place at the right time constitutes anything like righteousness. I was going to read an extended passage from Isaiah, but if you read the first Isaiah, what he says, the Lord says, is, I am sick and tired of your rituals, of your burnt offerings, of your incense, of your feasts and your Sabbaths, and all these external things. Who commanded you to do those things? He knows very well who commanded them to do those things. But he said, look, what I require of you is, comes out in King James, judgment, which means justice, to take care of the widows and the orphans and the oppressed. And when you've done that, then come back and we'll talk about feasts and Sabbaths and rituals. Basically, if you could talk to Mormons today, I mean, the analogous thing with Mormons, now I want to say that I actually believe there are a ton of Mormons who are doing way better than it sounds like the Jews of Isaiah's time were doing. There are a lot of people who are doing a lot of service, and I don't want to demean and say that we're not doing well. But individually, each of us deserves to ask in our hearts, where is the center? Do we view the externalities, the rites that we perform in the temple, as a path toward being righteous, or as the substance of being righteous, or do we view, my own personal weakness, our home teaching, or going out and actually spending time helping people learn how to read, or helping people be fed, as the main thing that God requires of us? I feel like there are people who spend, you know, two or three nights a week in temple service. If I ran the temple, I would say you have to earn the time that you spend in the temple. Okay? It's 1 or 2 hours of service for the living, redeeming the living, before you get a chance to go to the temple and put our priorities in the right place. And I would count teaching, I would count home teaching and all those kinds of things. But I wonder how Isaiah would view our idea of what constitutes righteousness. I really need to stop because my time is up. I want to say there's been a movement in my experience away from an efficiency model of what the temple is supposed to be, where we were counting what state you went to and you came from, and sort of counting the numbers of endowments and shooing people out of the slush room because they've been there too long, toward in the direction of allowing the temple to be more of a communion, more of a place of honest worship rather than the performance of a duty. I'm glad to see that. That's been true in my own experience, and I hope that it continues. Okay, lots more ideas from more people, and then we'll have discussion.
The three talks I might have previously given on a temple. One was my experience as female in a very male-oriented ritual. Another was my dream of a temple dedicated to the woman who thinks. And that one's actually written up right here on pink paper. The third one was the relationship of some Native American healing practices with which I'm familiar to parts of the Mormon temple experience. But what I want to say is that for many, many years I have struggled with negative experiences in the temple, feeling excluded, feeling left out, wanting to know what my mother's role was in the creation, being disturbed by Eve's silence through most of the ritual, etc. But during the past few months, I have had many men in the temples. And so what I want to do now is to tell you a little bit about some of those experiences, and then try to pull out what made the difference. And I'm not sure that I can do that very well, but I have some ideas about why that's been different for me, and a little bit about what some ideas I have on a more practical level about what might be fun if the temple included. I think I want to start with November. I'll start October. I hadn't been to the temple in a while and went, and this was my last really negative experience. And I was so upset that, and so sick to my stomach when I left that I thought, you know, I don't know if I'm ever coming back here. This is too painful. I just can't do this. The whole structure is too male. Everything is just too awful. But then I had a very dear friend, and I had promised her that I would be her escort to the temple when she went. And so I was back in November. And I had a good experience then. And then I proceeded to have some rather amazing experiences since then. And let me just tell about the experiences and then see if I can give you some ideas about what I think is happening. In January, I was talking to a very good friend in Austin, Texas, and she mentioned that a woman in her ward was going to go through the temple for the first time. And I used to be in this ward, and they had a band that was going up, and all the sisters in the ward were going, and I thought, oh, I'd like to go. And then I had this feeling like, I think I should be there. And it's kind of crazy, you know, I've been unemployed, and I don't have any money, and sure, I'm just going to fly to Texas. But I had the courage to say, yeah, a couple minutes later, I had this feeling a couple minutes ago, like maybe I'm supposed to be there. And she said, I did too. And then she said, you know, my brother has a free ticket. Maybe I could get it. Maybe you could come. And so I wound up going to Texas. It didn't all go perfectly, of course. FedEx didn't deliver, and that was a day later getting there than I wanted to be. But then when I was in the temple in Dallas with these women that I dearly love, I was understanding a lot of things, and it was like a revelatory experience, sort of like, you know, you dream about that doesn't ever happen. And I just understood things differently and in a way that made so much sense to me. And I wanted to be able to share this new thing. And so I pictured in my mind this group of sisters sitting in the celestial room and sharing experiences. And then it happened. And it was better than I imagined it, because I got to share what I was learning, and they shared what they had been learning, and one woman was a Jewish background, and she could share this sort of Jewish symbolism of the hand, and it was totally amazing. It was school of the prophetesses, and I got to be there. And so that was one. And there are a lot of changes going on in my life. And in January also, my bishop gave me this amazing blessing. And some people here would know about that because I've mentioned it before. But what I need to say at this point is that it wasn't news to me. What he promised me was already happening. I already kind of had an idea of it. And he confirmed to me what I was feeling. And he promised me that there would be many major, dramatic, overnight changes for the better in my life. And one of them had to do with my relationship with my daughter. So I had asked my son, my daughter and I had been quite estranged for years, and it's gotten worse recently, and I'm very concerned about my daughter. She lives in Salt Lake with her father. And so I'd asked my son, I had this idea, maybe I could take a vacation and take my daughter and just have a good time. Maybe she would come with me to go someplace fun. So I said to Daniel, my better terms with, where do you think Becca would go? Would Becca go, you know, where would she go? And he said, Hawaii. So I happened to have these vouchers from a year and a half ago from a nightmare plane trip back from South Korea. And I got the flight schedule, and I called the airlines, and sure enough, there's a really good deal on a flight from San Francisco to Hawaii. And I made these reservations tentatively, and I called and left a message on where my daughter is, and you know, I have to confirm within 24 hours. Will you call me back? She didn't call back. I called up and said, Becca, do you want to go to Hawaii? You know, no. So I went to the temple. And while I was there, there's a part where I talk about blessings on your posterity. And I really felt it. And I knew that somehow my daughter is going to be blessed, even though she identifies as non-Mormon. She hates Mormons. And then I sat in the celestial room and prayed for a while. And then the next morning, I remade the reservations, made it for a day or two shorter. I called up her high school, had her paged out of class. And I'm hanging on the phone going, what am I doing? She's going to be so furious. This is just going to make things worse. And I said, Rebecca, if you only had to miss 2.5 days of school, would you go to Hawaii? And it's a long pause. Yes. And then, so I just got back from Hawaii Wednesday morning, real early, and we had the most amazing experience. I mean, my daughter and I are on better terms than we've ever been on. That's all wonderful, better than I could imagine. And while I was there, I went to a temple in Hawaii, and I had amazing experiences there. Both inside and outside the temple and the temple grounds. And those of you that might be familiar with it, there's a hill that's actually above the temple in Hawaii, and it's a cemetery. And I was up there, and I just felt like singing a couple songs and praying, and I could feel things that will happen there, and that this is a gathering place, and that it's a sacred place. And there were just things that I felt and knew that were really important, and I had just this amazing whole experience in Hawaii. Okay, so I just got back, and so I guess the next thing that I want to say, I'm going to skip all this. What happened? What made this transformation possible? I think there's a transformation that's going on in my soul. I think it's based on faith, and I want to try to describe it because I want to encourage more people to maybe have something similar happen. I believe that I will receive the blessings I've been promised, and that makes it so that I can be happy now, because I know it's going to happen. The bishop's blessing confirms some stuff that was already going on. I don't need to try and control outcomes. I can say my truth calmly and let it go. I have this foundation underlying faith that everything's going to be okay, it's going to turn out, and I don't need to worry. And I spend so much of my life worrying about everything. So it makes a difference in all sorts of things. I start thinking instead, I think there's a way this can work, instead of that sort of adversarial, they're not going to do what I want, and I'm going to have to fight to get it, it's going to be awful. Instead, it's worked in lots of things. So part of the secret, I think, is creatively imagining good, positive, fun things happening, including having revelatory experiences in the temple. Because if you can dream of ways the temple experience could be glorious, you open up the possibility of it becoming that way. I'm a dreamer, and I've occasionally been privileged to see or feel certain things happening that have not yet happened. I had one of those experiences standing on the hilltop looking out over the Hawaii temple toward the ocean this last Monday. They have sessions on Monday morning at the death school. I bear witness that temples stand on holy ground, that they are places of revelation, that the many prayers which are offered in those sacred sites, beginning with the dedicatory prayers, and continuing with all the prayers that are said there, those prayers, I think, serve to create a powerful spiritual center, a sacred place of healing, of revelation, of joy, of comfort, of love, a place where heaven and earth connect again and again in the experiences of individuals. And perhaps this is the key. If the connections between heaven and earth are made often enough and strongly enough, someday maybe we'll be able to hold it together. Heaven and earth will be permanently united. The veil will be dissolved, and we will see as we are seen. I mean that we will see people on the other side of the veil as I believe they see us now. And I testify that this is beginning to happen right now. The major things I'm reminded of in the temple, my body and soul will be strong enough and healthy enough that I'll be able to do whatever I'm called to do. I will be able to keep walking until I get to where I'm supposed to go. If I'm faithful, I'll be protected, both physically and spiritually, until I accomplish what I'm here to accomplish, too. Need to watch out for ideas that sound like the gospel but are really men's or women's ideas. Since I've been a Sunstone participant since the beginning, I've given myself plenty of opportunities to struggle with this one. It's easy to be tempted to want more money than what we really need. My experience in third world countries teaches me that I need a whole lot less than what I grew up thinking I needed. Third, I've been promised that messengers from God will come to help me out from time to time. It's my job to recognize them and pay attention to what they have to teach me. I believe that if I'm paying attention, people and plants and animals and the earth herself and ocean and sky and sun will all teach me fascinating and good things on a daily basis. The amount that can be learned in this manner seems infinite. Four, I will learn to pray in a way that opens up the heavens. I believe that one may use one's entire body to pray, that one may sing and or dance a prayer. There are sacred dances that I've experienced that connect heaven and earth in a powerful way. I'd like to see recognition that there might be things eventually added to the temple ceremony as our knowledge and experience increase. Fifth, and this is the last one, when I'm ready to cross over to the other side, there will be someone there to embrace me and to welcome me home. I'd like to see a school of the prophetesses reestablished, perhaps a room off the celestial room or dedication of one ceiling room for this purpose. No, I've got two more sentences. You took long intro. My best experience with group-led prayer in the temple was when the officiator was a member of the Spanish-speaking branch that I was attending at the time. Perhaps because he knew the company of saints personally, the way he prayed was a way that was connected really with those people and their needs. So that would be another neat thing if ward members were praying for fellow sister ward members. I'd like to see mothers and grandmothers administering the initiatory ordinances to their daughters. My patriarchal blessing said that I would have joy and happiness in serving in the temples of the Lord and enjoy all the good things of life. And I think Hawaii couldn't have been a much better answer to that blessing.
I'd like to talk first about the concept of temple recommends and the related concept that non-Mormons and many Mormons should be strictly excluded from entering the temple. Temple recommends an exclusion of non-Mormons and less active Mormons from temple worship is such an accepted and ingrained part of Mormon culture now that it came as a shock to me when I recently started re-examining these concepts seriously as a result of the Steve Epperson firing at BYU. I think it is one of the few positive developments from that situation that it might cause some of us to reevaluate and rethink what could be called the temple recommend tradition in Mormonism. I'd like to start with Luke 18:10-14. Quote, two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. End quote. Let me emphasize that Pharisees have received lots of bad press over the centuries, but that many of them were sincere religious seekers who were trying to recover the purity of the law in a time of encroaching secularism. But I think they show us how easily a good religious ideal can suddenly, unexpectedly be turned into the complete opposite of itself. The tax collector, on the other hand, extorted more taxes than was just from fellow Jews on behalf of the hated conquering Gentiles, the Romans. Just the fact that he associated freely with Gentiles shows that he was a traitor to his religion, nation, and people. The fact that he became rich by this dishonest extortion made him even more hated and more of a sinner. The Pharisee, standing by himself, was praying thus. I'm quoting again. God, I thank you that I am not like other people, thieves, rogues, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give a tenth of all my income. But the tax collector, standing far off, would not even look up to heaven, but was beating his breast and saying, God be merciful to me, a sinner. Note the placement of the Pharisee vis-a-vis the tax collector. The tax collector stands far off. So that implies that the Pharisee is right in the middle of the temple courts. Note what may be a touch of pointed humor here. God, I thank you that I am not like other people. The Pharisee affirms that he is honest, not a thief or a tax collector. He is sexually pure. He is ritually observant, fasts twice a week. He pays exactly the required amount of money to the priesthood. I think Jesus portrays him as telling the truth. He does do all these things. The tax collector does not go down any such laundry list of his own virtues. He stands far off, not in the central court, because he does not feel that he is worthy. He openly calls himself a sinner, and his cry for mercy is brief but moving. Jesus ends the story with one of the paradoxes he loved. Quote, I tell you, this man, the tax collector, went down to his home justified rather than the other. For all who exalt themselves will be humbled, but all who humble themselves will be exalted. End quote. Jesus says explicitly that the tithe payer, the sexually pure man, the ritually observant man, the honest man, is not righteous. I don't want to underplay the fact that the Pharisee's essential unrighteousness, despite doing all these admirable deeds he's doing, is almost a difficult paradox, but that's what Christ says. Now I ask you, which one of these two men who prayed was a temple recommend holder by modern Mormon standards? The spatial interpretation of the parable is very interesting. We who have been nurtured in Nibley and Mircea Eliade have learned that sacred space is most sacred at the center. There is then a threshold, a boundary, enclosing the sacred space. In Greek mythology, if you stepped over the boundary of sacred space into centrality without authorization, bad things happened to you. You were eaten by a giant snake, or turned into a giant snake, or turned into a stag and torn to pieces by your own hounds. You get the idea. But the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector turns that concept on its head. According to the strange, beautiful paradox of this parable, the unrighteous person is most central in sacred space. The justified person is far off, away from the most central sacred space. Some of you might have a sense by now that I'm leading you into very odd theological territory. But I think Christ is leading that way, not me. Now hopefully this reading of the parable is causing you to think of many other passages in the Gospels. And again, we could think of the parable of the Good Samaritan, who holds the temple recommends in that parable. We have the two priests on their way to temple worship. And then we have the Samaritan, who was racially impure, was not able to enter the temple in Jerusalem, and he's the one who Christ picks as the hero of that parable. We remember that Jesus continually taught that righteousness done openly is not righteousness. The whole Sermon on the Mount is about this. Hypocrites, this is a simple Greek word for stage actors. I'm quoting Christ here. Hypocrites pay their tithes and offering publicly with fanfare. But Jesus enjoins us, quote, when you give alms, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your alms may be done in secret. And your Father who sees in secret will reward you. Note that wonderful hyperbolic phrase, let not your left hand know what your right hand is doing. That's pretty secret. The difficult but inspiring truth here is that a righteous act is not righteous simply because it is done. The only thing that makes a righteous act righteous is the motivation of the heart, which cannot really be judged by anyone but God. Now where does that leave the temple recommend? The temple recommend measures outward observance. The acts it measures may be righteous acts, but it cannot measure inner motivation. Furthermore, notice how its list of outward righteous deeds can encourage the mindset of the Pharisee in the parable. The temple recommend is a very public seal of righteousness. At least it isn't secret. It isn't between you and God. It's a contract between you and other people. If you say, I have a temple recommend, or if you simply attend a temple session, you're saying publicly, I pay tithing, I'm honest, I go to church every week. But notice, Jesus said, all these things should be completely private, even secret, between you and God only. If they are not secret, there is always the risk that your inner motivation is divided. Now let's add to this a policy in a church university or in a church business that all employees are required to have a temple recommend. Now the church is holding your livelihood and your family's livelihood as a motivating force to require you to pay tithing. In essence, they turn, Furthermore, any employee of the church, any professor at BYU, is required to be a public, not a secret tithe payer. If Christ rejected public righteous deeds, imagine what he thinks of forced righteous deeds. One of the tragic consequences of Steve Epperson's extremely tragic firing is that his tithing history became public. But BYU's policy virtually forces every single professor's tithing history to become an open book to the world. Some church members see this as a good thing, but is it consistent with Jesus' teachings? Can a BYU professor pay his alms in secret so that God can reward him in secret? This policy takes away from the authentic devotion and purely given alms of many sincerely faithful BYU professors. But the very policy of temple recommends is a policy of emphasizing outward public performance rather than a concern for self-examination and inner motivation. So there is a problem there even before the element of requiring the temple recommend is introduced. Okay, so some people may be saying, if we have no temple recommends, how do we keep non-Mormons and less active Mormons, and one of our latest euphemisms, out of our temples? Let me answer by describing a situation that probably many of you have experienced. Not too long ago, one of my nieces was scheduled to be married in the Salt Lake Temple. She's one of my favorite nieces, as they all are, so I wanted to be there to witness it. My temple recommend had expired, so it needed to be renewed. Now, I began thinking about the wedding. My oldest sister, the niece's mother, had a recommend, as did my parents and my brother. My two younger sisters did not have recommends, have been less active, quote-unquote, for years, and have interesting religious histories, just like we more active siblings have interesting histories, religious histories. So I thought of them outside the temple walls, waiting while we shared the joy of a marriage within. How are we supposed to feel in this situation, we fully active Mormons? Is it their own fault that they're out there? Do they deserve it? Is it a good negative experience for them, so they will be motivated to eventually become fully active Mormons? I wondered, would Jesus leave them outside the temple walls while the rest of the family went inside for the marriage? Or would he stay outside with the sinners? Yeah, let's see. 1 minute left, huh? Well, we can look back at Christ's life and look at how much of his time he spent with sinners and how much the Pharisees hated him because he spent time with people who were not racially impure Samaritans, prostitutes, tax collectors, Gentiles. And in our opening parable, it is the sinner far off, not in the accepted sacred center, who is authentically holy. If you follow me in this interpretation of Jesus' teachings, then inviting non-Mormons and less active Mormons into our temples will only increase their sacred natures. I think being inside the temple can inspire people to repent as much as, or perhaps even more than, being left outside. Okay, real quick. Finally, briefly, I think open temples could create many opportunities for using temples as centers for community service, for education, for mutual rejoicing and dance. When I'm called to be a temple president, I'm sure a call will come to me any day now. There will be a room for the local Mormon chapter of Amnesty International in my temple. Jorge Luis Borges once said that he had always viewed paradise as a library, so I think the temples should have excellent libraries and archives. And by the way, I think that everyone should take the time to visit the beautiful RLDS temple in Missouri, which follows many of my views of how an open temple could be. And then I have some stuff about how in the earliest temples, Kirtland and Nauvoo, they were quite open temples. So I hope that in the future our temples can be defined by radical inclusiveness rather than by exclusiveness. Thank you.
Alice, the earliest playwright we have in the Latin language, said, "The theater is a temple." I'd like to talk about the temple as a theater. The temple building itself is the set. Not the setting, but the set. The backdrop. A symbolic statement. I am talking about both our modern temples and the temples of ancient times. They all share the same theme. Each temple is a set, a representation of the primordial mountain. The first land created, the first to rise out of chaos, out of water. That's why most of our modern temples are surrounded by water. And why most of them are on high ground. So it was in ancient times. In ancient belief, the primordial ground is held sacred, because that's where God first stood on earth. It's from that place that he finished the creation. Anciently, the creation was ritually acted and danced up. Jacob saw the ladder on higher ground. Moses went up to the top of the mountain for the Ten Commandments. You're familiar with all these things. In the early days of the modern church, before the temples were built, the ordinances were performed on the highest ground. Inside our temples today, it is the altar that is the central place, representing the primordial mountain. Because our modern temples do represent creation, it is commanded, well, I don't know how much of it is a fact, that no two are allowed to be exactly alike. You can't represent creation and look like all the chapels. The baptism font rests on 12 oxen underground on purpose. You know these symbolisms. Baptism imitates death, burial, return to chaos and rebirth, recreation, becoming a new person. Extending metaphors enriches their meaning. But then realizing the metaphor in our own lives, making the metaphor real by becoming a new person in Christ, makes the metaphor significant, making it real rather than just an abstraction. Middle Eastern temples differ from one another individually, but they all share the same concept. In the Temple of Karnak, which stands about 500 miles south of Cairo, there is one story among many on a wall of hieroglyphics that I want to share with you. You know how they kind of look like a cartoon strip. The first block, a man is being anointed. The anointing drops of oil are drawn as signs of the priesthood. In the second block, the man is being dressed in a loincloth and a hat. There's a partition, it's not a wall, it's not a veil, it's a partition. And then he is greeted by God sitting on a throne. And in the last box, he is brought to and embraced by Mother. You remember that the pyramids in Egypt were originally gold on the very top. The rising sun was dazzled first on the golden top and then shine on the Nile. The gold represented God, creation, wonder. The Nile represents chaos. Those Egyptians had a real sense of drama. In Egypt, Babylon, and other parts of ancient East, the annual festival, which was the center and climax of all religious activities of the year, contained, according to Professor Hoke in The Origins of Religion, five shared elements. I'd like to share two of them with you because of the time. First, the dramatic representation of the death and resurrection of God. The goddess had an important part to play in the resurrection of her husband. Anak made possible Baal Hadad's resurrection by attacking and destroying his enemy Mot, the god of death. In Mesopotamia myth, it was Inanna Ishtar who descended into the realm of the dead to destroy Ur-Shagal's power so that the dead, Dumuzi Tamas, could be restored to life. Aristides' apology describes how Aphrodite descended into Hades to ransom Andonis, I just mispronounced that one, from Persephone. Sibyl likewise made possible the resurrection of Attis on the third day. While in Egypt, it is Isis who made possible the resurrection of her husband, Osiris. But no matter what the details of these ubiquitous Near Eastern deaths and resurrection legends, the underlying theme is the same. The god is helpless without his consort. Our temple is a place for couples. The message is clear. One partner cannot make it without the other. Nibley suggests the primal ritual drama, the one from which all other drama arose, was a ritual enactment of the creation of the world. that would give the temple drama a very long history. Our stories and ritual dramas give us our cultural identity and give us the big picture. In the temple, I feel the depth and breadth of my roots. I share in the midst of ancestors I never even thought of as ancestors. I am reminded that God is not just Mormon God, but global. The temple reminds us of the broadness of the gospel. Joseph Campbell says that ritual means reiteration. The sacred reiteration and participation in the temple puts us in touch with our most ancient roots. Thousands of years ago, people were doing the same thing. It can feel pretty weird by modern standards, but we want to come out of the modern world. We can get in touch with our most ancient roots. We explore the creation, and we explore our place in it. Kathleen Flake has a wonderful insight on the taboo of discussing most aspects of the temple. The great advantage of keeping the temple secret is that no one can tell you how it's to be interpreted. You have to build your own interpretation and your own way of experiencing it for yourself. No one in the position of ecclesiastical authority will come between you and the text, imagery, ritual. The secrecy of the ceremony also guarantees its intimacy as something between the individual and God. Jenna Kincaid and I were sharing how the initiatory work is the most intimate temple experience for us. There's an intimacy with God and with women. The experience is direct. Only this and private prayer allows this intimacy between God and woman without going through another man. It is terrifically empowering. God covenants with us, giving us rich blessing. Ironically, it is the secrecy that begets the freedom of worship. The most ancient rituals took place out in the woods. So does the most modern drama out in the woods of Poland with Rokowski. In As You Like It, Shakespeare says there is no clock in the forest. There is no clock in the temple, not where we are. In sacred space, time is abolished, and we can become contemporary with everyone who lived before, and that is why Peter, James, and John can drop in and visit in the garden. This is where we share what is eternal in time, to turn from the results of creation to its mystery, from the world of creation to the creation of the world. One of the things I love about the story of creation in Genesis is its austerity and poetic formality. It is presented with enormous abstraction, without sensory detail about how things look, sound, feel. But Psalm 104, speaking of creation, tells us that God wore a glorious robe of light, spreading out the heavens like a tent cloth and riding in the wind. Genesis tells us of a God who speaks, makes, and forms. Something beyond the human imagination. The temple is closer to Genesis. It brings to us vision and sound. Some read Shakespeare and the King James Bible and think, what a yawn. Some watch the temple film and think, boring. In a 1983 study that has revolutionized teaching, 8 different forms of intelligence were identified. Schools traditionally use and test only 2. After Gloucester's eyes are plucked out in King Lear, he says, I see it feelingly. The best teaching involves the whole person, all the senses, and touches on all the varied learning styles. Some learn visually, some learn orally. These learners, who might plod through the reading of scripture as drudgery, will be uplifted and instructed in the temple film. Those who don't learn this way figure out just when to wake up and participate. So much in the church has become less participatory. In the LA temple, we could get up and leave the garden, not just watch someone else leave it. And in the murals on the wall, we've become increasingly passive and less involved emotionally. Rabbis don't study to get the answers, but to ponder the questions. Anthropologists and drama historians trace the primal ritual drama, not to the creation, but to the hunt. Hand-to-hand combat with a bear took enormous courage, enacting the feat beforehand with the full backing of the community through dance and song, and the religious blessing readied the young hunters for the ordeal ahead. Our personal spiritual journey can be as frightening and certainly as difficult as facing a bear. So one of the things we do is to come to the temple to prepare ourselves for this spiritual journey. In 3 Nephi, Jesus says, "That which I have done, ye shall do also." We are to imitate him, to do what he has done before. In the temple, a pattern is laid out for us. Through imitation of the archetypes, we are projected into the mythical epic in which the archetypes were first revealed. They are performed at the same mythical instance in the beginning. I was bothered by the play the first times that I saw it, because I was trained in realistic drama. But the more I come to understand modern drama, and very modern drama is what we do at City Light, I have come to appreciate the what I thought it was cardboard, one-dimensional characters, because they're the archetypal characters, and we fill out, we are to think of ourselves as them. And if they were already playing a three-dimensional character, they would define who we are and limit us. So we have to fill in the rest as we identify with them and make it personal and make it our journey and help the person that we're going through for to do the same thing. One of the significance of the invention of writing on history is that when you had only oral tradition, changed as needed to fit present needs, and no one was the wiser. The little changes from generation to generation went unnoticed because there was no record to compare the versions against. Certainly our temple ceremony has changed with the time. When anthropologists listen to tribal elders, I love this, somewhere in Africa, recount a tale of their ancestor king who had 7 sons. He later learned from historical evidence that the particular king had only 5 sons. But the time the story was being told, there were 7 tribes in that area. The details were changed to fit political expediency at the time. We have light actors in 2 of our temples. To my shame, I have never seen them. I was rather a snob about watching old people who can't act. Well, now old people are much younger than they used to be. And my definition of acting is much broader. Every new cast to perform the temple ceremony could bring some new understanding, some new nuance. There is a change to some extent in every performance, and this affects the observers. There could be many more opportunities for new insights. I love live theater. It's a very intimate experience for the audience and the actor. Film is more visceral and more immediate. Metaphor is unity. Metaphor is unitary. That is, it can be grasped all at once as a unit. It is extensible. That is, the likening process can go on and on and on as far as you want to take it. An unsophisticated Shakespearean audience wants to see historical productions in Elizabethan dress properly. Sophisticated audiences are excited by new ways to relate it to today in contra outfits. Joseph Campbell encourages us to take a story and turn it into a metaphor. That makes it a message for our own life. That is why Jesus taught in parables. Storytelling is the oldest form of theater. And I'm not a fan. But I do want to, I was just going to be, I was going to do the whole history of theater and just read out Shakespeare. But I do want to share one thing, two things. One thing about Machiavelli, who you probably, you might not think of as a playwright, but he was a very good one, as well as a political theorist. I just find it really interesting that for him, a happy world is a world of deception and masks. People need to believe things that are not true and that they know are not true. For Machiavelli, it is the end that must be considered in all things. No human action is beyond justification. He has influenced us. He's a powerful man, and we must be very careful. So I'll end with a quote from Northrop Frye, the great critic, who comments in The Anatomy of Criticism that the passion of Christ, the story of Christ, reflects the structure of comedy. The protagonist is trapped in a potentially tragic situation caused by a law, and the happy ending comes when the law is subverted and overturned. Midley talks about how unfashionable it is to have God in a machine, but isn't that really how we say it? Isn't that really what life is like? God comes down and saves us in the end. So we have a setting, we have a set, we have costumes, we have a play. I invite you to go back to the temple and look at it in a slightly new light, and especially I invite you to feel awe. Every director will tell his actors, feel awe this week.
Well, I guess I am like most general authorities or presiding officers. Boring, boring person who closes this. Always the period, never the exclamation point. I'm just a tinkerer when I think about church, its programs and things, and so I'll share just a few things which I would change in the temple to help make it better. I like Kim, I see much of our temple covenants as collective and social, as well as individual. We say yes together to the covenants, and we are saved together as a community as much as we are individually. In fact, but it seems to me we focus, when we go through the temple, so much on us as an individual, making these covenants, becoming clean, going through, sitting in the celestial room and meditating. If heaven is like the celestial room, it's not a place I would really like to be. It's a quiet but really boring and deceptive place for much of my occasion. The place in the temple what I think is probably most like heaven is the cafeteria. I remember going to the temple many times before temple trips, and we all go through a session, and then we go to the session room, and we're spiritual, and we hug each other, whisper a few words, we're very polite, and then we go down to the cafeteria and eat a meal together,
and enjoy so much love with everyone and talk and converse and share our lives. And, you know, Joseph Smith said the same sociality that exists here will exist there, only better. And that is what I think the celestial room or celestial kingdom could be like. So I would like to think there was a celestial kingdom and have it much more like a family reunion, like heaven will be, I think. So that's one suggestion, is to put refreshments in the room. I'm not really being clear, but I don't think that would work practically. But the point is to find a way to make that work. I do believe that the temple is a house of learning. And I once heard a story where someone once had a minister describe his creed to them, and the Mormon replied, "I cannot understand it. It is a mystery to me." And the minister replied, "That is the beauty of it." For many people who go to the temple, I think that describes their experience of this, of the ritual. It's alien and foreign to them, and many Mormons say to them, "That is the beauty of it, that we cannot understand it. You don't need to go through." It seems strange to me that we don't do that for other rituals. When a person is getting baptized, we go to great lengths to explain what this ritual means to them. You know, you're being death, you're being buried, you're coming alive again, and we sit there and we have all these metaphors that we tell people as missionaries, and we tell children to make it, you're being washed clean, your sins will be off, so that the ritual has meaning to them, so it's not just something foreign and alien. I think for many people who experience the temple endowment in the first part of the church, we're familiar with the sonic parallels. Those symbols were not alien to them as they are to people in this 20th century culture. As just as we had explaining many of the rituals and metaphors today, I would like to see that happen. Not publicly, not outside of the temple, and not officially. I would like to see a lecture series, perhaps held in the Solemn Assembly Hall in Salt Lake Temple, and videotaped, and available for people to come to the other temples and to go into a room and be able to watch unibly or different people share their ideas from an anthropological, historical, theological perspective, all perhaps introduced and made non-official by the church. So there is no official interpretation of the temple, but there are helpful tools so that people can have the ritual be more meaningful in them. Similarly, a library where people could go and read and watch videos and come to understand the ritual better. I think that would be very helpful in making the temple ritual more meaningful for people. It's also a house of prayer and a house of worship. We emphasize most today a house of work, a house of work for the dead. After you get your endowment, you go back to do the rituals for those who died. But I think we can do more to make it a house of worship and a house of prayer. To make it a house of worship, I think we need to teach Mormons how to meditate. I personally have found that when I want revelation, I don't go to church on Sunday, and I don't go to temple, although I could do that for that. I go to a Quaker service for a meeting for worship and secrets and quiet. I sit in their meeting, and it is true, you sit for an hour, your mind, you're fidgety, and you want to leave, and your mind is full of all the to-do items that you need to do, but in time, they pass. And the stillness around you enters in you, and when it's quiet, you do are able to hear what we would call the still small voice. You're able to see the inner light within you. It percolates up, and you can leave the revelation. We don't know how to do that kind of meditation. From what I read, Joseph Smith tried to do it once in the Perkins Temple, and it really didn't work very well. But Celestial Room would be a good place to do that, I don't think. But meditation chapels off of Celestial Room, where people really want a place of quiet to do that kind of worship, happens. Actually, today we tell people not to pray. You know, I've been in the Celestial Room, and the other people have, where people are sitting there, and they say, "Are you praying?" And Yeah, so that's not the place to do it, to the celestial room. And workers are told to tell people not to do that. In fact, I've been told not to talk about the temple in the celestial room with other people. Another way to make the temple a house of worship is to expand the use of prayer circles. We are taught how to do the two-order prayer in the endowment, and we participate in prayers as an example. But I understand how the brethren, the apostles, use the prayer circle each Thursday when they meet in their temple meeting. They go to the temple, they dress in their robes, and they stand and do a prayer circle, and the matters which they discuss, they pray a thousand. One of them is the voice. I think the temple could be a similar place for our administrative bodies. State presidency, high council, bishoprics, elders current presidency, relief society presidency, go to the temple after they have a presidency meeting or before, go to an endowment, and then pray about the matter. Family, to schedule a room, an altar room, a ceiling room, where they could go similarly to do that. What happens when you do a prayer circle, since everyone is supposed to have no hard feelings towards anyone else, requires us to truly become like Zion, where heaven and earth meet in the temple. Because before we do a prayer circle, we have to clean up our relations with everyone we're going to be in the circle with. And so we go, and we are at that moment, heaven, connected in love, praying over common matters that we have. I think that would make it a place of prayer and revelation for our day-to-day personal and religious life, which could make the temple very meaningful in our daily life. Those are some of the main sort of tinkering ideas I've been doing. I think they would substantially make it a place where we would look forward to go, would purify us in the process, and make it more than just a house of work, a house of learning, a house of prayer, a house of worship, and a house of revelation. Thank you.
I really appreciate everybody's contributions. One of the things that I cut out of mine was that I would like things like this, where people, especially like what Bonnie did, talking about what she's learned there, where there's I feel like we can stand and raise our sights about what's possible in the temple, and everyone here has really contributed to that for me, to raising my sights. The time is over, but there's 2 hours till dinner. Until the next thing, we have 2 hours for dinner. I'm going to ask if five people is probably enough people to have heard from, but if somebody else wants to contribute something for a minute and have responses, we'll try to be open. Yeah, Tim.
I really believe that what Bonnie and Elbert talked about is going to happen real soon. And maybe talk that my bishop, I've been a bishop in my ward, I was called Bell's conference, you know. I really
think that's great. Thank you. Thanks, Tim.
It's important to not be like other places. So I would not want to become a community meeting hall with the International Library. I do remember when the old people did the ritual. It did not give new nuances. They frequently forgot. The technicolor temple, though, doesn't do it for me. Those old people kept me awake because I wondered when they would forget. Even though exactly what's going down there was technical. It's very boring. It just plays itself out. And those people, I also had a sense of their service, and I don't have a sense of the service performed by the people on the street.
Okay, thanks. My own personal experience is that I did catch that nuance sometimes. I felt there were really different interpretations going on up there, in addition to occasional lapses. Tim?
When the actors did it, things happened to me that didn't happen to me because they were actually doing things for the chorus. I was sitting in the Salt Lake Temple one time, and the LOV cast stayed now. I felt somebody get off my lap and go back out the door.
Wow.
So things, I watched the movie and but it doesn't have the same kind of effect. I was in the Salt Lake Temple when Todd and I were at MHA last night, and even though we moved on the Masonic symbolism, it still is the same.
The drama theorists could talk about the difference between movies and live action. It would be really interesting. Lori?
Well, my feeling about it is that if they have to do the film, in other words, not really set up, usually they can film live actors doing the thing, because the major thing that bothers me about the film is that it throws you back into almost a literal mindset, whereas if the actors in Temple Guard doing the ceremony keep it on a symbolic level, and so it reinforces the symbolic elements of the temple. So again, even if they have to have film, I'd rather have them film old people, live actors, you know, doing it.
One of the advantages to live actors is that it retains the abstraction and symbolism rather than making it really literal in a setting in a garden, and that a movie of that could be done instead of a movie of a reenactment of creation or something. That's great.
I just wanted to add one thing I didn't say is I think it would be really neat in the prayer circle if they let the people who are standing there add something. You don't have to stand there and I hope he says if they need you with special needs. You know, that people could add a sentence going around with it.
Thank you all for coming, for your spirits and interest.